A Tale of Two Individualisms was presented by Casey Pilcher at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
All right. The Tale of Two Individualisms. You know, Dickens' novel highlights the two cities. It's kind of nice because this highlights the, not London, Paris, but Britain and France, the continent. So anyway, The Tale of Two Individualisms is where we're going to start. But before we go anywhere, we're going to do my disclaimer. The views expressed during this presentation are those of the presenter as of very late last night and are not necessarily those of the presenter at this very moment. Because I just sat through a discussion with Jack, and Jack always clarifies. So I'm going to feel free and be at liberty to kind of morph this as I go on. The presenter reserves the right to moderate, change, inhibit, exhibit, verbalize, even to finish the presentation through interpretive dance if I feel like that's going to be more helpful. And lastly, no animals were harmed in the process of this presentation. Okay. Except for the cows. I keep picking on the cows. Right. Okay. So as we discussed in the beginning, this essay, in his essay, he begins with The Tale of Two Individualisms. And he kind of starts with who developed these worldviews. Under the British tradition, he has, of course, Locke, Smith, Burke, de Tocqueville, Lord Acton is another important individual. On the continental side, which he calls pseudo-individualism, he has Descartes, the physiocrats, Rousseau, and the encyclopedists. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these. I'm just trying to fill in and give you guys kind of an outline of the essay as I understood it. So hopefully this will be helpful to you. Okay, then he explains the essential characteristic of both traditions. So on the British side, the characteristics is that man is limited, imperfect, fallible, and requires humility. Okay, man is limited. That means he is limited in his abilities. I don't know if you guys remember the Federalist Papers that we read yesterday, but Madison indicated that due to the imperfect reason of man, he will not always agree. And that's kind of one of the reasons why factions rise up. Madison is pulling from the traditional version of man, very much so, the British tradition. On the continental side, we have reason with a capital R. The encyclopedists, Diderot and his, yes. I'm filling that out right now, actually, yes. So we have reason with a capital R. But please feel free to ask questions during this. So let me fill this out and see if it doesn't answer your question. So the encyclopedists, Diderot and others, had a project to provide a complete alphabetical treatment of the whole field of human knowledge. Okay, that is reason with a capital R. Oh my goodness, that you can take all of knowledge and put it into like the 75-volume set on sale today for $79.99. That's a profound sense that we can capture all of our knowledge, all of human knowledge, and put it somewhere. So, is that, kind of fill it out? Okay, other traits, man is perfectible and malleable. What I mean by that is that he's perfectible and malleable in like a socializing kind of way. He can be shaped, he can be molded, he can be socialized towards a certain direction. The main thing is it just requires time and rationality. Rationality gets, that's a word that gets filled out a little bit in the essay. Rationality is man's ability. You know what? Yeah, well, But it's that our reason in the Cartesian tradition, that we can capture all that there is to know in and be rationalistically provide a step-by-step method by which we can know something. It's very systematic. Yes, it's a good word. Okay. Totally. Remember in the British tradition that we discussed earlier, it's highlighting the limits to mankind's knowledge. It's not saying, I mean, these are reasonable men who are writing, who are explaining that mankind has limits to his knowledge. So they're expressing their reason in coming up with this whole philosophy that, hey, mankind is limited. It's just on the opposite side, you've almost got the sense that knowledge is perfectly attainable and can be perfectly articulated in the 75-volume set of the encyclopedia. So the essential characteristics of man affected the respective notions of individualism, and these ideas had consequences, not surprisingly, on how man should organize. So how should man organize? Hayek outlines various things in his essay. First of all, it should be allowed to be spontaneous, but that means there will be unforeseen results, and to some degree it will be unpredictable. I'll hit on the notion of predictability in a moment. On the continental side, it should be designed through deliberate planning, so it will be predictable. Ironically, we need to come back to this notion of predictability, because ironically, on the British side is actually more predictable. On the continental side, it's actually less predictable. But we're going to kind of come back to that. That's just, on the British side, it's allowing man to be man, and we all know that man and as man works together with each other, there's a level of unpredictability there. But on the, if you plan something, if you lay it out in a set of rules and laws and lists and bureaucracies, supposedly you should have a level of predictability. That's the attraction to the continental side. Okay. So certainly there are more consequences to the two traditions. I'm just kind of filling out some of the words that Hayek uses in his essay. But he looks at the two traditions, the two views of individualism and the expectations of social organization, and this is what he concludes. That on the one side you'll have true individualism, and on the other side the social organization will be socialism. What do I mean by that? I will explain that further. Okay. So now you have the tale of two worldviews. He's discarding the Cartesian notion of individualism he's saying you can't really have that phrase, I think. I mean, at least that's how I read it. He's saying that term needs to be reserved for the British tradition. On the other side, because it leads to a more collectivist, a more socialist approach, he gave them the word socialism. Well, he allowed them to have that word socialism. I mean, that's, anyway, we don't need to go too far into that. But so now it's a tale of two worldviews. I'd like to define worldview because that is a confusing term. It gets used all the time. I prefer the German phrase, but what we'll do is I'll just give you the Wikipedia definition that was actually really good. It is the framework of ideas and beliefs through which an individual interprets the world and interacts with it. So beliefs and ideas through which the individual interprets the world and interacts with it. This becomes really important because Hayek is claiming that a certain view of man with certain characteristics will lead always to a certain view of society. So therefore, if we go back, if individuals have these characteristics, you're going to get, it will lead to these conclusions about society. So Hayek is setting us up. He's describing two perspectives of what it means to be human. They lead to two very different conclusions. He's not trying to be formulaic here. He's describing this natural progression of each perspective. And it ends with how a person should be organized. Again, we'll flesh this out with two quirky metaphors. But it's very interesting that we started from this notion, individualism, and where those two traditions take us is to this great divide. We're standing on this Grand Canyon, and on the one side you have individualism, and on the other side you have socialism. My experience, and the experience of most of the stuff I've read, when people get to this place, when they're looking at this Grand Canyon between these two social organizations, which highlights the Grand Canyon in our own country. What do people do? They make an oral, moral argument to justify their position. Very understandable, but it becomes from the two sides of the canyon, people shouting back and forth moral arguments. Just to highlight this, I lead a reading group in Portland. We've been meeting for about, I think it's 9 years. And I love the question of social organization and economics and political theory. I just love it. So this whole reading group is pretty much dedicated to understanding how do people organize themselves? How do we do it well? Every discussion I've had practically for the last 10 years, because half come from one tradition, another half come from another tradition, comes down to like a roundabout with no exits of moral arguments. And we go round and around and around and around. And it's basically who can make the stronger moral imperative that wins the day. Well, Hayek, he doesn't really do that. That's really not where he's going. And I don't think that was really highlighted in this essay, but it's highlighted in some of his other work. So we're going to go into that. Hayek does not make a moral argument. He does not make an argument really about incentive or responsibility, although that's part of it. Hayek, in my mind, does not make any argument typically used when faced with the great divide between individualism and socialism. Hayek's going to take it a different direction instead. Hayek makes an epistemological argument. Okay. Well, I know I never got to the quirky but hopefully helpful sketch. I'm going to get to it later, but it's not here. I would like somebody to define epistemology. Tim. How do we know what we know? How do we know that what we know is true? And anything else? Anybody want to add to that? Okay, Dick, where's Dick? There you are. Can you give us the Greek for epistemology? Yes. I know. No. Well, this is... Yeah, is that to know to understand? And that, did I fill it out well enough? Okay. Way to go. Okay, so how do we know that what we know is true? So if we go back to our essential characteristics, so on the one side, he's making an epistemological distinction between the two traditions. He's saying on the one side, man has epistemological limits. He's limited. On the other side, there's a sense that on the continental side, that man has reason with a capital R. The encyclopedist. We can alphabetize the whole range of human knowledge. So if man can do that, certainly he can form the best society. We can figure the society thing out. Well, on the British side, you've got the founding fathers who knew that man had limited knowledge. So their whole goal was limit the sphere of his influence. He has limited knowledge. We need to limit the sphere of his influence. Okay, so where am I? So from this, Hayek makes an extraordinary conclusion. Yes, that's his conclusion. So individualism is logically or epistemologically, it's possible. Socialism is logically or epistemologically impossible. So it's an epistemological argument. He states that socialism is impossible. That, quite frankly, should make you raise one eyebrow and cause you to ponder. Because he's not saying, hey, it just doesn't quite work well with humanity. He's not saying, yeah, it's just a bad ideology. He's saying it is downright impossible, and we're going to start to fill that out. So our reaction should be, why? Hopefully that's what you guys are thinking at this moment. Why? Okay. So I'm going to delve deeper into two analogies that express Hayek's perspective more clearly. He doesn't just say they're impossible. He doesn't just end there. He doesn't just say one's impossible, one works. He's actually he develops a whole philosophy that explains why each of them are the way they are. So we're going to do two quirky metaphors. The first quirky metaphor is the island. Okay, the island represents individualism. And if we can look at it in this kind of abstract way, I think it'll capture what Hayek is interested in. So the island represents a sustainable ecosystem. The island's ecosystem, it is a complex order. Air, sunlight, water, etc., all interact with organisms transferring energy from one to another, sustaining life. It is complex, but it is sustained by the interaction and the knowledge and the self-direction of all the organisms that intuitively work together. By the way, this is rentable for $7,500 a week. Yeah, that's more accurate. $7,500 a week. We're going to assume that no one has set foot on this island and that by and large the ecosystem's undisturbed. There's no noxious weeds or like crazy animals like ferrets or elephants. There is what there is. Okay. If you don't bring ferrets, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the island is made of individual organisms, and we're going to use a leaf as an example, that work together to form various processes like the nutrient cycle. So if you guys remember the nutrient cycle, the leaf pulls from the leaf falls, the tree decomposes, the leaf pulls, the tree pulls back in the decomposed leaf. There is a cycle that's going on. It's by and large, it's intuitive. There's no one pulling the leaf off and putting it on the ground next to the tree that's to absorb it. It's organic. Okay? Hayek actually has a term for this that he applies to society. These various processes are called spontaneous social formations. The organisms interact intuitively, organically, without planning, and they are spontaneous. Okay? Because of this, the processes are flexible and adaptable. So if you have a leaf that falls down from a tree, but say the wind catches it and carries it down way over here, well, a different tree or a different plant life is going to benefit from that decomposing leaf. No one's pulling it off and putting it where it needs to decompose. Okay, all of the social formations work together in harmony to create an extended order, which is the island. Okay? Second quirky metaphor. That is the Death Star. It's not meant to be disparaging. I know the word death is in it and associated with evil, darkness, and like a power-hungry emperor who's probably a bit OCD. And, you know, it doesn't hurt that you have Darth Vader who can use the Force. But this is based on Hayek's description, what I think he's saying about socialism. The Death Star is an artificially created, highly engineered, and totally designed planet. So, in contrast, it is not made up of individual organisms, but of mechanisms. Individual mechanisms, like the thermometer, work together with various processes like the HVAC system. These various processes cannot be spontaneous. They are highly engineered in design, which means they are inflexible. If one breaks down, it will inevitably affect something else. All the engineer processes work together like an enormous machine, each process relying on the other. Okay, so according to Hayek, the island represents spontaneous social organizations working together to create an extended order. This order comes about naturally and organically. The Death Star represents a social whole that comes about through the meticulous design, planning, and engineering of all the details so that they work together in like really a perfectly holistic way. Further, the island, all knowledge of how the complex extended order works on an individual level, on the level of the organisms. That knowledge is intuitive, it's subjective, and it works together in unintentional harmony. That's what Hayek's going to say. I mean, we can stop there and go into a whole explanation of, is it really unintentional? Because, you know, what do you do with God as the designer? But he's not going to deal with that. So just put that aside and let's hear about his argument that it's by and large an unintentional harmony. The Death Star, all knowledge is understood from a central location so that it can be certain that all systems work together and are functioning properly. These two metaphors are meant to capture the abstract ideas of individualism and socialism as Hayek sees them. But let's take the metaphor, and then we're going to translate it to society and see how that kind of works, because they're very abstract. Okay, so knowledge. Remember, Hayek is always going to be trying to tackle this from an epistemological perspective. Knowledge is on the level of individual people. It's literally, that's where it resides. Let me do this. I think this is kind of helpful. So, all of humanity, all of the United States, is represented in here, this whole economy. Knowledge, and say this is all filled out with humans, little people. He's saying the knowledge, this knowledge, is just on how the society works, is literally dispersed throughout. So you have some of it here, some of it here, some of it here, some of it here. And it plays itself out in a dynamic that is, by and large, intuitive, but it's dispersed throughout. Okay, on the socialism side, knowledge is captured, all of this knowledge, the attempt is to capture it from a centralized position. Let's assume you've got Darth Vader up there. Having the Force would be helpful for him, but he's able to capture all of that knowledge from a centralized location. So, as knowledge is dispersed, social formations will occur organically. They can do that because that's how the dynamic works. On the other side, social formations occur deliberately. Okay, so social formations, let's get a couple of ideas. Nonprofits, associations, churches, newspapers, radios, cooperatives, Great Books College in Eugene. These are all spontaneous organizations, especially this one. You guys should. Yeah, anyway. Knowledge that is centralized is expressed through bureaucracy, government, programs, regulations, etc. So all that's going to occur, the social formations have to occur deliberately. Okay, on the individualism side, society relies on tradition, morals, values, and relationships to function. So the social formations like church, nonprofits, and the NGOs rely on those things which serve as the fabric of our society. Traditions, morals, values, and relationships all help in this dynamic to build these small social formations. Okay. On the other side, social formations that rely on centralization rely on formulas, laws, and government to function. Okay, one of the consequences of this is society operates on a dynamic that is flexible and intuitive. When on the side of individualism. On the side of socialism, society operates on mechanisms that are instituted. And you can especially see this when it comes to our economy. I'm not going to go into that right now, but you can see how you can have two economic worldviews playing out just in that one idea, that there can be a dynamic that is flexible and intuitive, or that it requires mechanisms that are instituted. Okay, is everybody following me so far? Okay. So society, Hayek's going to argue that society has built-in mechanisms to keep it in check. One profound mechanism that definitely came up in our discussion group, hopefully it came up in your guys's, is that consequences to one's own action is a profound mechanism. So in these relationships, in that limited social sphere where people are interacting, you're going to have consequences to bad choices. That is going to be a determining factor on where the direction of society goes. Hayek relies on that profoundly. He also relies on not just only the relational interpersonal mechanisms, but he also relies on the price mechanism, because he is, by and large, an economist. And let me just say that the price mechanism is a very strange force in our country. I'm still working on understanding it, but just really quickly, profits, losses, how much or how little something costs, sends a message to individuals. If there is a service to be performed, which is only performed currently by a monopoly. Okay, that service will be expensive, of course. That signals to entrepreneurs that competitors are necessary. Individuals create more options. More options create competition. Of course, competition lowers prices. Society doesn't, we don't know how that price mechanism works. We don't even need to know that there is a price mechanism. But it plays as a profound dynamic in the shaping of especially the United States and especially the early America. Okay, so when, on the flip side, when there's a highly centralized system, society must be looked at like an enormous machine. If something isn't working properly, and people are not getting the service they need, government has to figure out how to supply that need, see that it is distributed evenly, and that is done in a timely manner. Now, that sounds simple enough. To be honest, we all love planning. We all want. It's a very comforting notion that someone can take care of the planning. So I'm going to give you guys... Whoa. There we go. I'm going to give you guys a very understandable, real-life story about how planning occurred in Santiago, Chile. Okay, in Santiago, Chile, they used to have a private urban bus transit system. It was private. It worked really well. Understandably, it had some issues, but it operated in the black for years. There were no public subsidies. Only those who used it paid for it, and it operated $60 million in the black. The government looked at that $60 million, and they said, why are these guys benefiting so much financially, the profit here, on what should be a public service? So they've got a profit problem. They're making too much money, so we're going to take it over. The government takes over the bus system, and to my knowledge, to this day, it's still operating to $600 million in the red. It's a profound distinction. And ironically, the ridership is actually less. So what was once done, well, let's look at the differences. So when it was privatized, this is where you get this organic, flexible, intuitive, what Hayek is trying to fill out very much in this analogy. When it's privatized, the routes were determined by where people wanted to go. The driver came up with an organic plan, so it wasn't necessarily spontaneous, but he worked with his riders to figure out a plan. He had that flexibility because he knew his passengers. And as the passengers, they knew him. He had the ability, he had the knowledge of what it took to make that route. He developed the route, and he got people to their destination in about 40 minutes. Now, granted, there were different kinds of buses, and there were different kinds of buses for different kinds of classes. You had the penny rider, which was the old jalopy that didn't get serviced very often. It was probably belching black smoke and all sorts of problems. But then you had the more expensive. It's going to cost you a little bit more, but it's the express bus, and you get coffee. They actually use that. You can get coffee on the bus. I thought that was nice. So people paid for whatever service they wanted. You'd have both options. You'd have the coffee service or the old beater jalopy. But it was an organic process that the people of Santiago figured out. 3,000 individual bus providers created this system for Santiago. And it was getting taken care of. It was getting done in 40 minutes. Okay, under the public, the government didn't like the profit problem. They took it over from private industry. And they didn't just do it because there was a profit problem. There was an equality problem. Why do people get coffee and the jalopies don't? You know, that's not fair. Let's make this public service perfectly equal. So, and there was another obvious problem that there were no planned routes. They didn't like the no planned routes. We need to have planned routes because, you know, that helps with the predictability. So the government took it over. We're gonna make it equal. We're gonna provide the same kind of reliable service, and we're gonna give you planned routes. So now, yay! They've taken it. Everything should work. Well, with the old bus system, we said 40 minutes. With the new bus system, you've now got a 2-hour commute. Wow! The privatized, the prices were flexible. The plan, the system, no longer has the ability to flex and provide opportunities. So, okay. Oh, and. This is Incentive also, of course, played. Do we want to open that door? Are you guys getting hot? Yeah, it's kind of warm here. Okay. Incentive also played an enormous issue. When it was privatized, the bus driver would be paid by the passengers. So you've got the 30 people hanging out on the street corner. So you can imagine, like, the last scene of Ben-Hur with a chariot race. You've got two buses vying for the same group of 30 people. Dang it, somebody was going to pick them up because that was where the money was to be made. So it was stiff competition and probably pretty scary at times. I mean, the description of these two buses, you know, cutting each other off. And the 30 scared passengers, oh no, you know. But they knew they were going to get picked up by somebody. Okay, under the new system, understandably, all the planning that they made was very understandable. It just didn't quite work out the way they wanted to. So they were paid to stay on time and on schedule. So what does that mean? So no longer do you have the chariot race. You've got like the hitchhiker syndrome. The jalopy, no, it's not a jalopy. It's the nice bus is going down the road and it's thinking I'm 5 minutes late and oh my gosh, there's 30 people. It doesn't look, hits the gas and speeds on by. And so the poor 30 people are going, my bus. And that's, yeah, I'm not going to pick you up. I got to stay on time. That's how I'm paid. So what we just gone over is there are all these built-in mechanisms to keep it in check. Although society instituted these formulaic mechanisms to keep it in check, Hayek's going to argue it cannot know that from a socialist perspective and from a planning perspective, it cannot know. It does not have the access to the kind of knowledge that is required to make a well-run bus system that had the benefits that the individual visualism one had. So, okay. Okay, guys, we're almost done here. And then we can ask some questions. Lastly, this is kind of obvious, but unintended consequences create new opportunities. So Hayek's system relies on failure. It relies on things not working out. It's because it's an organic system. It's when there is an unintended consequence and when there is a failure, that is an opportunity for someone else. That makes a lot of sense to me. On the other side, unintended consequences, the reaction is we have to create new mechanisms. This is kind of going back to our Santiago bus analogy. The government could have stepped in and regulated the buses. And I think Hayek would have said, look, some decent regulation is in order here. The bus that's belching black puffs of smoke or the people that are vying for the same group and, you know, clip a passenger, that's not good. So they said, we're going to come in and we're not going to regulate, we are going to control it. Well, one of the unintended consequences of Santiago's bus system is that whoever bought the buses forgot to measure them. They made, understandably, they got these really wide, very long, nice little accordion middle bus. Well, you've got a bus, you've got a lane, a street lane that's about this big, you've got a bus now that's about this big. So you've got a picture, you know where I'm going with this. So before you'd clip a passenger or two, now you're taking them out. I know. Massive unintended consequence. So sideswiping cars, taking out people, so much so that the government actually ponied up an apology. That they actually, I can't remember the name, that they actually ponied up an apology and said, we really screwed up. And you guys are paying for these really expensive big buses that are kind of wreaking havoc. What did they do? They didn't give it back. They didn't give it back and they decide, okay, we'll give it back to you guys. But, you know, you guys are going to have to play by some rules. No, they just said, we'll create a new mechanism. And we'll just keep, we're not going to give it back and regulate. We're going to reform. And we're going to reform. And we're going to reform. And we see that all the time. That's just an example of a phenomena that occurs all the time. Okay, so it's about epistemology for Hayek. And we can talk about this more because you guys may have a different perspective. He's saying subjective intuitive knowledge is the necessary epistemology to understand social organizations. Hayek believes that all facts about how a society has worked is actually dispersed through all of society. It cannot be collected and measured. It cannot be studied or controlled. Unless you're Darth Vader or the Emperor up here who can use the Force, he's saying that information, it's an impossibility, and it's a bankrupt project. So further, the concrete knowledge that guides the action of any group of people never exists in it as a consistent and coherent body. It only exists in the dispersed, incomplete, and inconsistent form in which it appears in many individual minds and the dispersion and imperfection of all. Lastly, the collective knowledge in a society that makes a well-run society cannot be captured in a formula, mathematical calculation, or any other objective measurement because the knowledge, some of this is redundant, but I want you guys to really capture this. Because the knowledge is dispersed, every individual brings to society a set of beliefs of subjective, intuitive knowledge that makes the collective knowledge work. Okay. So, the Death Star. Totally impossible. And that's after it was destroyed by the Federation, right? Isn't it the Federation? That's Star Trek. As being rebelled. Okay. The Rebellion. We can take that analogy so far. We won't. Okay, so in his own words, the case of individualist rests on the contention that much of what, in the opinion of many, can be brought about by conscious direction can be better achieved by the voluntary and spontaneous collaboration of individuals. So, that's my last slide. So I'm going to give a disclaimer real fast, and then I'll take questions. Because it's really important. Hayek does not reject planning. He's not saying all planning is carte blanche bad. I mean, we plan in our own lives all the time. In these little social formations, we plan. And we develop hierarchies. Hayek is relying on that. What he's relying on is the limit to what planning can occur. Planning has to occur in this very limited sphere, because that is the limits to man's epistemology. That's the limits to what he can know. Okay. You need some water? Seems to be giving some water. Okay. Where am I? So what he criticizes a certain kind of planning. Not the planning that will he's criticizing ultimately the planning that is supposed to take place of the voluntary and spontaneous collaboration. So when planning starts doing this massive top-down effort to control all these individuals, that's what he's against. He's not against a natural hierarchy that's going to come about, and he's not against, you know, the building codes or the FDA. He is going to put limits on those institutions, though, and how they function. And he is going to want them to acknowledge that the building codes is not the final say of all knowledge. We need to be able to interact with each other, because that builder down the road, we were talking about this in our discussion group, that builder down the road who comes in to the jurisdiction with a set of plans, he may say, look, my 50 years of experience with a hammer may make more sense than your 10 years of experience at the desk. And they should be able to interact. But he's not going to do away with the building codes. Okay. And I think, just to go back, I think Hayek would defend that regulation is very necessary with the Santiago bus system. The fact that people were getting clipped, probably because of the stiff competition, he'd have an issue with that, reasonably. He would say, stop taking out people's elbows. Let's figure out a way where we can regulate the system a little bit. Okay, so in conclusion, I just want to end with this. We discussed this. I don't know. Hopefully, you guys discuss this as well. One of the greatest contentions against individualism is that it's selfish, and that man is isolated, or that man isolates himself. Hayek's position is interesting because it relies on the fact that man won't isolate himself. Families, free associations, relationships, nonprofits, church, all become very important. It is through these limited spheres of influence that mankind thrives. It is also through these relationships that the collective knowledge of man is utilized. And it creates the activity necessary, ultimately, for a whole society to work.